welcome to episode 58 of Crying in the Book Club, the internet's second ever podcast about comic books, but only one currently running as far, to my knowledge, as far as I'm aware.
We're number two.
Yeah. And you know what? It's great because we're number two to a podcast that we all, to our own podcast. So, you know, it's kind of nice to have a monopoly over the space.
We were number one.
Yeah. Joining me, as always, is Emily, who you've already heard.
Hello.
Number one in my book. Number one podcast host.
Wow. Thanks, John.
You're welcome. And number two in my book, simply by virtue of not hosting nearly as many podcasts. So can't, like, you know, can't give him too many flowers. My good friend and yours, Alex, is here.
Hello.
What's up, Alex?
Oh. Things are good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Watch some cinema films this week.
Well, oh, I'm sure it'll come up, but Alex and I had a transcendental experience over the weekend.
It's a very good word for it.
It was a really beautiful 3.5 hours, of which, yes, I enjoyed every second. Okay. So, you know, we can save that for the cry space, because I shed tears during it.
I'm sure you did.
Many tears. Really riveting emotional movie. We'll get to that. It's not every day you watch a 3.5 hour movie and it's like one of the best things you've ever seen. But we are not here to talk about 3.5 hour movies, which may or may not be directed by a person who's made a lot of great superhero films. But we are here to talk about superheroes. Some would say these are better than those superhero films. Some would say this is worse. I'm not going to come down on the side of this, but we are here to talk about Green Lantern, Green Arrow by Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams, which is a book that we've actually had on our list of things to cover for...
Literally since the beginning.
Probably the beginning. Yeah.
I think it was when we did our initial brainstorming. This is one of the things that we talked about doing an episode on.
Mm-hmm.
I have never read this. This is like one of my big blind spots. So I was excited to finally get around to it. We did not read the whole thing. We read the first 10 issues. I think because I was like, yeah, we're going to have a quick turnaround from recording the last episode to recording this one. So we'll only do like 10 issues. And then, you know, we had to delay it first for, you know, things that are out of our control, then for something that was in my control, but I, you know, prioritized and didn't work out. But anyway, you know, we read the first 10 issues. If I had known what the 11th issue was, I would have made us read it.
I actually did read the 11th issue.
I read it too.
I didn't want to leave off on the cliffhanger.
Oh, no. So you guys read both of the Snowbirds Don't Fly issues, right?
Yeah.
I read the John Stewart one.
What Alex mentioned is the one that I was referring to. The issue after what we read. So we read issues 76 to 86 of Green Lantern. And issue 87 is the introduction of John Stewart, who is the Green Lantern that appears in like the Justice League Unlimited cartoons and stuff. And I knew I knew he was a Denny O'Neil Neil Adams creation. I thought it was later, and if I had done my research, I would have had us all read that issue, because it is an important issue and does kind of dovetail with some of the themes of the rest of the book. So
it is pretty funny that we stopped right there.
Yeah. You know, not intentional. I didn't leave out the introduction of the first Black Green Lantern because I'm racist. I did it because I'm stupid. which is way better, I would say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this was to give a little bit of background on this, I've already mentioned Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams. This is like one of the most acclaimed DC comics of all time. I feel like
year-wise, when did this come out?
So this came out in 1970.
Okay.
70.
It was earlier than that, but
no, so 70 on the dot. They took over, well, they took over the Green Lantern comic and added Green Arrow to the title and as a recurring character. So this isn't like a separate spinoff series. It just, the Green Lantern series just became Green Lantern and Green Arrow for a long time. This is a pretty long run. The characters were already kind of in the midst of being reimagined at this point. Green Arrow had been pretty heavily redesigned prior to this and had also had been given like a new backstory where he had lost his massive fortune as Oliver Queen and, you know, is out in the world on his own as Green Arrow without the vast amount of money behind him. And had already sort of started taking on the sort of political ideology that we see here, that we see in the book. And, you know, Green Lantern, similarly, not a redesign or like a change to the backstory, but, you know, they wanted to bring him back to Earth, make the character a little more grounded, a little less space opera-y. Throughout the 60s, that had really been like what the Green Lantern series had been. Like Hal Jordan was barely ever on Earth. That's when characters like Sinestro and Star Sapphire were introduced. So this is like a pretty different take on, for at least at the time, this is a pretty different take on Hal Jordan. And obviously it's like oscillated a lot back and forth in the years since. I think after this, he sort of remained like an Earth-based hero. Obviously when Geoff Johns took over the character, became like, did all the big space opera stuff again. So Green Lantern has kind of always been like a weirdly flexible character, and really like wildly different stuff happens in Green Lantern books, even relative to like other superhero characters. I'm getting into the plot summary. If I were to go beat by beat, this would be like really long and incredibly dense, even though the plot is fairly straightforward for this book. Mm-hmm. It's a bit paradoxical in that sense, because like each issue is so dense, but really it all kind of boils down to very simple conflict. But the crux of the book is that Hal Jordan returns to Earth, and one of the first thing he does when he comes back to Earth is he just, you know, as superheroes do, he just runs across a guy getting assaulted in the middle of the street. And, you know, doing his superheroic stuff, he saves the guy getting assaulted, you know, it's all good, right? Except the guy who was being assaulted was a landlord, and so deserved to be assaulted in that way. And that is the official stance of the Crying in the Book Club podcast. And, you know, so he apprehends the guy who committed the assault, and immediately the whole neighborhood turns on him. They like start throwing fruit and vegetables and shit at him, just pelting him from the balconies. And one of the people who is just tossing stuff in his direction happens to be Green Lantern, who's just sitting there on the stoop, like, fuck this guy. Obviously, Green Lantern and Green Arrow, like, you know, they're not homies yet, but they do know each other. And so Hal's a little taken aback. And at that point, Green Arrow explains to him that the landlord had been exploiting the tenants for years, had, like, not been repairing the building, was increasing rents, and now was in the process of evicting all the poor old people who live there so that he could turn the building into a parking lot to make even more profits for doing nothing and just being a leech on society. So Hal goes after the landlord because he's now convinced actually this guy is the bad guy, and he gets recalled to Oa by the Guardians, who tell him that, hey, you're really out of line here. You can't be doing this to somebody who hasn't actually committed any crimes. So he decides, well, I guess I'll just go prove that he's committing crimes. So he goes back to Earth, and then along with Green Arrow is able to expose the landlord's crimes. They get the DA in there and they arrest him, and, you know, it's all good, right? Except no, because Ollie now is convinced that Hal has no idea what it's like on Earth. He's completely out of touch. And so he needs to take him on a long road trip across the United States. Just bros hanging out. You know, it was going to be a great time. The two of them just chilling. And it gets fucking ruined because the Guardians are like, no, you have to take one of us with you. So they send one of the Guardians down to Earth, who takes on a human form and ruins the vibe. Like, I mean, sometimes you just want a duo trip, man. Like, third wheel was really unfortunate for those two, I feel. And over the course of those 10 issues, they do a lot of stuff. They overthrow a minor baron who's exploiting his workers. They save Black Canary and a Native American tribe from a white supremacist cult. They save an interstellar court from a revolt by their mechanic and his robots. They fight a school cook who is exploiting a telepathic orphan to control the other kids. Black Hand shows up, you know, running a company town and using the smog produced by the factory to subdue and control the people of the town. All at the same time, you know, Carol Ferris and Dinah Lance, Black Canary, are like just off screen. And the guys are like, man, we really love these women. What do we do about this? And so they, you know, they deal with all their love interests. And then, of course, most famously, is they discover that Green Arrow's sidekick Speedy is a deeply in the hole for heroin. He thinks heroin is very poggers, which maybe he's right. Maybe they should have heard him out a little longer on that one. And they do the very famous two-issue arc that closes off what we read called Snowbirds Don't Fly, which, you know, deals with the heroin more the drug cult crisis in general in the 60s and 70s, and then, you know, because they were kind of woke for the time, they even are like, oh, it's actually Big Pharma that's doing this, which, you know, they were cooking a little bit in those issues. Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, I think they knew ball to an extent. So that's kind of the background. I'm curious to hear your guys' general thoughts. Top level. Well, wherever you want to start, I mean, feel free to just dive in.
Okay, first of all,
there's a lot in these 10 issues, though.
First of all, the realization that a significant portion of these issues was going to be a road trip story, like, I would have started so much sooner if I had known that. Oh, I was so fucking delighted when I realized that that's what they were doing with this. And I honestly, like, as I tweeted around when I started reading the issues, like when we were going to record the first time, like, this comic is so corny, but it's also, like, kind of based a lot of the time. And it's just, like, a lot of this run really delighted me, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. Some of it, I felt like I thought the Black Hand issue was kind of a drag. Just like pacing wise, like I just wasn't enjoying it as much as the rest of it. But I did not know anything about the Speedy drug issues, or that this is apparently a famous arc in, or a famous story in Green Arrow.
You'd never seen the cover of issue 85 before?
I had never heard of this in my life. So wow. When I got to this next issue and that I saw that we were having a very special episode about drugs, I was cackling. I was, again, delighted. I'm a sucker for a very special episode. I just a couple nights ago forced my IRL like best friend here to watch the very special drug episode of Gem and the Holograms. So it felt a little timely for me. And I said these comics were so fucking corny, but like they were cooking. Like there were some stances and things that were said in many of these issues where I just like wasn't expecting that to be the position that a mainstream comic book would take at the time. So I don't know, I had a great fucking time. Disappointed they didn't kiss, you know, but what are you gonna do?
I think there's probably plenty of fanfics where
I could find it for sure. Case. Yeah, but
no, I mean, we kind of talked about this a few episodes ago with God Loves, Man Kills, but yeah, like it is kind of jarring now to go back to read superhero comics from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and, you know, kind of remember that at one point, like, a lot of the people who wrote comics were, like, way more left-leaning, and that was, like, there was the controls on, like, what you could write about, like, were not as strict.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first issue, issue 85, the first issue of Snowbirds Don't Fly, starts with that thing at the top of page one. It's like, some will say the following story should not be told. And it's like, you know, but we're going to tell it anyway. It's like it has a great spirit. It has a great spirit to it. Alex, what did you think? Oh, Alex is frozen.
Oh, that's bad. Oh, no.
Oh,
wait, oh. Alex is back.
Alex moved.
I think.
The comic made me think a lot of things I never thought about, really. Yeah, I learned a lot about things and a lot of new ideas, like landlord's bad, cops bad, cults, religious cults bad. It's you know, I don't agree with any of them, but hopefully the other side of them.
It's good to open yourself up to new ideas every now and then, Alex.
Yeah, I know, but I guess, mild joking aside, I owned and read the first volume for, I don't know, 5 years ago, and I got to interview Denny O'Neil back when I was doing video game, comic, whatever, journalism stuff, which was cool, because we talked about this book. It was like, I called him, and we had like a 2-hour conversation, and this was like probably a year before he died, thereabouts.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Like, and that interview never got posted, but I have the transcript of it. I have all that, and it's probably my favorite interview I've ever done. And it's just,
oh wow,
interesting guy.
You should just write out the interview, and we can like post it on our website.
May as well. Yeah, 20 minutes of that was him being like, you know what? I never liked Neil Adams. He was an asshole. But he could draw a comic, and I was like, you know what?
He could draw a fucking comic.
It doesn't surprise me.
Neil Adams was kind of a kook.
He was. But yeah, this book is I enjoyed it when I read it years ago. It was nice to read it again and read more, because I'd only read the first volume, which is the first 5 issues. So I never read the famous Speedy Drug issue, which is just such a treat. Such a treat of an issue. And... yeah, it's interesting book where like it's like so not subtle in anything it does, but when put into the context of the time it came out in, it's like really, really cool that it was pushing these boundaries, and it was you know, doing this, and like Jean-Luc said, it's kind of crazy that like left-leaning comic creators were kind of a thing then. And I mean, I would say this was probably the start of it for a lot of it, because after this we really had a lot of other people follow in their place, and we had a lot of the sort of British invasion going on, which was, you know, obviously a couple decades later, but this was really I would say definitely a start for it, and a lot of people would credit it for it. So I'd say a very important piece of comic book, one that ages kind of strangely into today's date with how things are going, but kind of in a, I don't know, it's kind of in a nice way, and like a little bit of like, oh wow, look at them being so like over the top with this stuff that we sort of somewhat take for granted now. So
yeah, it is kind of funny that the first issue opens on like a story about an evil landlord. Well, I guess I shouldn't, you know, repeat myself, but a landlord exploiting people, which is just like, it's like a Twitter meme now, the whole fuck landlords, like we all hate landlords, which is a good trend to have. But it is kind of funny to go back to this, because it really felt like in like 2019 or 2020, it was like a lot of people started like saying stuff like that in like, and it was like back in the popular conscience, I think. Mm-hmm. Because of COVID largely, like obviously the issues never went away, but it's like, you know, you didn't really see stuff like that break containment from, you know, like, you know, weird kind of lefty spaces. And mm-hmm. So to read this in an era where that's like, where it's so, that kind of a discourse is much more prominent, is really funny to think that, oh, this was just on, like, you could buy this comic at like, you know, the local deli or whatever on the spinner rack. and it sold 500,000 copies or some like insane unattainable number for modern comics. And it's just like, yeah, your landlord is an evil parasite who does nothing for society and does not care about you and will turn on you on a dime to make a profit because that's all they're fucking good for.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's like, sorry, I guess I said that like, oh, like it's funny looking back on this and some stuff that's really different, but it also is like so much of the stuff is still like, oh, it's just
so many
as
of the issues that are in this comic are like things that people still deal with in like various ways, like, you know, the problems have changed over time because just the world has changed over time, but like there's still like a lot that really resonates here in a way that I did not expect at all.
Yeah, I mean it's unfortunate, but a lot of those problems have not gone away, which, you know, makes it like our understanding of them has maybe gotten better over time, but they certainly existed then and they exist now. And so it like it's weird because in a sense, and I think Emily, you alluded to this a little bit earlier, that, you know, there's a lot of stuff in here that's corny. And I don't know if you said this explicitly, but like there is a degree of this book that feels a little bit dated just because like,
oh, absolutely.
The way comics are written has changed so much, but the material is just as relevant as it was back then. Like, I mean, 50 years ago, over 50 years ago.
Yeah, it's like some of the ways that they talk about things is very obviously dated, but like the like essence of what they are saying still like really holds true and is like is like a solid foundation for like the ideological stance of the comic.
Yeah, I mean, the second issue is like about, you know, a mining town where the laborers are being exploited by the person who owns the mine, who also happens to own the local jail, and also has hired an ex like Nazi prison camp guard to run the prison, which is like not so far from the truth. Like, I do enjoy the like how intertwined this, and I don't know if they knew about like Operation Paperclip back in the 70s. I think that was like something that came out a lot later. But, you know, like they were onto something with the like literal Nazis being brought in to in positions of extreme power. It is kind of interesting to see all that stuff in there. I mean, even the pharma thing in the last issue, like I don't know this because I'm not familiar with like after school specials about drugs or whatever, but to make the connection that it is actually like the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, we saw this with the opioid epidemic most recently, but like the truism there like was actually like I was a little bit taken aback that they actually went there and it wasn't just a like you have to over resist the allure of illegal drugs type, you know, story.
As a very special episode aficionado, like this was like one of the most like nuanced and like not shitty and bad like ways of addressing this topic. Like it felt like the circumstances were all fairly realistic, which like, and I think it just comes down to like, also just, I guess the difference in like making something that goes on TV versus in going out in a comic, because like a lot of times when you have very special episodes in TV shows, they have to kind of like abstract the drug to like, they don't use like, it's not usually specifically heroin. Like I think at the most, like they'll maybe specifically do weed, but like a lot of times it's like nondescript pill or like nondescript powder or like, you know, like, and so it felt like this story, even for being like a very special episode, was like very grounded, and also like just the fact that it like the fact that it brought up like systemic issues at all was just like totally like mind blowing to me, because you're right. Like normally these are about like, you know, just resisting the allure of drugs and not falling in with bad people. And yeah. like there's a, you know, there's plenty of that in this to be sure. But like the, you know, the fact that they like let Speedy like have his little speech at the end, like was, I was impressed. And,
Yeah, and it's still, like, very after-school special in the sense that, like, oh, Speedy's addicted to drugs. And then suddenly he's like, you know what? Not anymore.
And he got over it on
I beat the drugs, and I did it on my own, and I'm gonna punch you, Green Arrow. And I mean, I know the book, like...
Admittedly, it is incredible... It is incredibly funny that like part of the plot of this particular two issue set is that Speedy is so sad that Green Arrow is not paying attention to him, so he gets addicted to heroin.
It's like specifically like, oh, he's off with like his lady friend Dinah Lance for too long. Like they're having too much sex, and Speedy's like, oh man, I guess I'll do some heroin, but I'll get over it soon. Don't worry. It's all going to be okay. Yeah. And then, I mean, like, and Green Arrow's reaction to it is just like, you know, Speedy's doing drugs. And he just like punches him in the face and is like, why are you doing drugs? And it's just like, that was such a jarring moment. Like I think I'd heard about it when talking about this issue, but it was just such like a, what? In terms of like it really is like a different time, I guess, where like, hey, any drugs, anytime you do anything, you're like, stop, no, don't do
I
it.
I mean, look, to be fair, like heroin, like if you're at a point where you are injecting heroin, that's pretty serious. Like,
yeah, but I feel like the solution is not to beat the shit out of the kid, you know? It's like,
no, not at all. But it does, just it like, does whoa. Kind of feel. It does kind of feel like a realistic reaction from Green Arrow, like as a character.
I mean, I do also like it as a. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, anyway, go ahead. Yeah. No, I was a bit like, he's very like this whole thing. He's like this whole comic. He's kind of being like, oh, Green Lantern, you got to get down off your pedestal. You got to see this stuff. And I guess it is strong in the sense that like Speedy's a blind spot for him, where he never thought that, you know, his word or Speedy would do anything like that. But then he kind of just like. Completely like he just fucks up completely, and then he doesn't really have a redemption moment other than like, oh, good job to get off the drugs, haha. Good sock. Like
he's proud of him at the end, which I think there is a bit of a redemption, like the bit where he's like, I'm holding back tears because of how proud of my ward I am. But I actually do think it's a kind of a good character beat for Green Arrow, who, you know, for most of it is basically, you know, talking to Green Lantern, like, you're a stupid piece of shit. You're a dumbass. You have no idea what you're talking about. You don't know anything. Yeah. But then, you know, he also, like, you know, he's newly no longer a multi-millionaire. And like, I think it's not just that, like, the Speedy thing is a blind spot. I think it's, you know, almost more general than that, where it's easy for him to kind of abstract the structural problems when... You know, it's like when you're fighting like the landlord, and it's like, oh, we can like expose what he's doing and take him to the DA, do some detective work with the white supremacists that they run into later, the cult. It's like, yeah, we can just beat their ass and, you know, more or less move on. But it is, I think it is a good character beat for him too, when he sees it like in his own life. He still has. It kind of says something about, you know, sort of the reactionary nature of like America and living in America, where even you can be like the most like theoried up, like read all the books, you know, have seen things firsthand. And then when you see like something happening like in your vicinity, like you just freak out and completely lose your mind about it, you know? Like,
yeah.
we go through this shit like every 2 years, where it's like, you know, odd numbered years because there's no elections, like every white person is the wokest like you know, anti-police, like fuck 12, like out in the streets all day. And then as soon as it's an election year, they just fall for the crime narratives again. Mm-hmm. And it just like rotates back and forth, which, so I think it is interesting to like give him like a personal failing in the same way that I think probably, and I don't want to necessarily speculate, but probably in a way that, you know, the like, Denny O'Neill probably had that same experience, right? Or at some point of like, you see the contradiction, you see those things happen up front, and all of a sudden there's this contradictory feeling in your head of like, I know it's a systemic issue, but also this is happening in front of me to somebody that I know and I care about. And, you know, it kind of warps your views on things and causes you to react in ways that aren't necessarily rational, which I think is a good character beat for him to have. Like, it's important that
it gives him a little more dimension.
Absolutely. Yeah, that exactly. He's not just the guy, like, he's not just like, you know,
he's not just here to like tell Green Lantern ideology, like, you're doing here. A shitty job. You don't know.
Yeah, yeah, right. He's not just reading The Wretched of the Earth to Green Lantern for, you know, which, you know, would be very epic also. But, you know, honestly, like, but yeah, like, Emily's absolutely right that, you know, fleshing him out in that way and giving him like character flaws and not having him just be like the author stand-in to beat up on Green Lantern
I was surprised reading these 10 issues how many of them are like bangers, in the sense that like they're like monumental kind of issues, like, oh, this is this one, and this is like the speedy drug one, and here's the one with John Stewart, which is the 11th one we read. Like, in terms of like I don't know how long the run actually ends up being, because I know, like, you know, we read 10 here, but it's got to be up there in terms of like single issues that had the biggest like impact, or in terms of like people know about them, or just like even just the covers, they're so striking and it's like so clear what's going on. And I'm not sure if Neil Adams is also doing the cover art on this series, but whoever is, it's a really good work too.
Yeah, I mean, the run lasts, like, I think it runs about 50 issues, maybe a little bit more even.
Nice.
But it goes on for quite a while, and you are absolutely right. I mean, like, obviously the speedy issue is super iconic, but I think part of it is just going back and looking at some of these old covers. Like, there is a real charm to them. I mean, we've completely now gotten away from text bubbles on the cover, on comic covers, and so, you know, having that kind of like set up the story is super fun, especially, like, you know, obviously, you know, like, oh, there's going to be some twist, like, this is like this the second issue we read, issue 77, you know, the cover is green, like Green Arrow looks dead on the ground and Green Lantern's like ring isn't working. But I love the sort of melodrama of that, of like, you kind of are immediately upfront see like what the conflict is going to be, and you know there's going to be some, like, there's going to be some wrench thrown into it where there's another dimension to the conflict that the cover isn't telling you. But it's like exciting to, when you get to the moment where that happened, where either what's portrayed on the cover starts happening, or they show you how they overcome like the obstacle that's on the cover. Like, it's just really fun. Even the, obviously you don't have the experience of like seeing it on a shelf and being like, oh my God, is Green Arrow going to get killed by, or is Green Lantern going to get killed by Green Arrow wearing a racist Native American outfit?
Yep.
Find out. Like, you know, it is one of those things that's like, you don't get the full experience because you're not like buying it off a stand, but you do get the, you know, you get like, you still get like the next best thing reading through issues, which is really fun.
Yeah, and I'd say it's really not like, because a lot of, you know, comics for a long time, it's like, here's the cover and what's inside really has nothing to do with it. I wasn't disappointed with any of the cover to thing, because it, like, you know, you do get that moment, you just might not be exactly how it looks like on the cover, and it's cool to see as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. A lot of the covers are really cool. I mean, the art in general is really good.
Yeah.
I read parts of it in the DC Universe app and parts of it through less legal means. but I pay for the subscription, so I don't feel bad about it. But one thing that I will say is that, and I know I've harped on this before on this show, but in the DC app, they have the digital recolorings of all the issues, which going back and looking at some of the, like, reading a couple of the issues without that, like, there is such, and they're kind of shitty scans, I'm going to be honest, that I'm looking at, but you can just see, just even in those shitty scans, like, how much more depth the color has to it. Like, there's, especially in the issues where they're like, there's the two at the end, the Snowbirds Don't Fly arc, but also the one Native American issue where Green Lantern goes back to the city. Like, you get such a sense for the atmosphere of the city through the colors that just isn't there in the digital recolorings, which is such a bummer, because these, and I mean, part of it is like, it's a shame that a lot of these didn't survive, like, you know, high, like, you know, mint condition, like, editions of these issues that could be put out. Like, it's a shame that they probably just don't exist at this point.
Yeah.
Or if they do, they're like exceedingly rare, because there's a real richness to the coloring, even in the scans, that I think is really impressive and is definitely missing.
Great.
Did you guys have a favorite issue? I know one of you said you didn't care for the Black Hand issue specifically. Oh, that had to be Emily. Alex had to be in the bag.
I love Black Hand.
I don't really have that much experience with Black Hand, so. But
and a scholar.
As far as favorite issues, it's probably the Speedy issues. I really liked the Speedy arc, and I really liked the very first arc in the beginning with the landlord. And I don't know. I guess I just like the concept of like of superheroes on like a road trip with their boss, or like one of theirs boss. I know that he's not technically Green Arrow's boss, but.
It is kind of a shame that they get away from the road trip structure, especially because it's not like the issues continue kind of being one shots.
I mean,
they go to space, I guess, but it is kind of a shame they get away from that structure, because I think it does. There is a real driving force through the first. I think it's what, six
a real
issues.
Driving force.
Yeah. I genuinely unintended.
Part, no, I but, could tell by the way you said it, but
yeah, it's. That is there in those first few issues of like, oh, well, what are they going to see next? Like, what weird thing are they going to come across in the country next? And like, they continue kind of doing that, but it is a really cool setup for a
series. It's really fun.
I mean, eventually they do lose the Guardian. He's just like, I'm going to stay on this planet with overpopulation. And it's like, oh, okay.
Yes.
Cool.
But they could just go back to being two bros driving around in a pickup truck.
That's what they wanted all along. Suddenly they stopped driving. Come on.
Exactly.
Come on. We don't
know.
Well,
they started getting tied down.
Yeah.
They started getting tied down, like Hal, you know, rekindles his love with Carol Ferris, and, you know,
which I think
Black Canary
is the first.
Lures.
Yeah. I think that's the first canon moment where Green Lantern Hal Jordan lets Carol know that he's, you know, Green Lantern Hal Jordan, which is like,
oh, is it really? I had no idea.
Which is a cool,
honestly.
Like, oh, look, something moved forward, huh?
Yeah,
nice.
It's funny because, and she's also not Star Sapphire at this point. Like, Star Sapphire exists, but it's not Carol Ferris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure if that was a Geoff Johns creation or if that's a '90s thing right before Johns, but
I don't know, to be honest.
But, in terms of favorite issues, I mean, the first one's just so strong in setting it up, and it really nails the tone for the rest of the series, and does so in a way that just feels like this was the first story, and they knew they were going to tell it, and this is how they were going to do it. And there's that scene with the guy who's like, hey, you do all this work for people with purple skin, but what about people with black skin? And Green Lantern's like, fuck. But the way that page is also just colored and drawn, it's gorgeous. And then I also love
how relentlessly Green Lantern just gets owned by facts and logic throughout the series.
It's really good.
If you're a Green Lantern hater, ooh.
See, the Green Lantern haters are actually down on this, have to be down on this, right? Because like, he changes and grows as a result of new information. He's not just constantly getting owned. Like, he's constantly like going back into his thought. Like, you constantly get the, like, it goes back to the internal monologue of him, like, you know, pondering his new experiences and how he's going to adapt to his the new information, which is, you know, it's good character work.
Yeah, and then the second issue I really like is the one where it's just the prison town, and it's the Nazi guard, and you got the guy who's captured, who's the folk hero guy, and I thought that one was fun. Nice little time.
Died too, but Dylan style character. Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, they're all good issues. I really like the first Black Canary issue, which I think is 78. It just has that, like, the second or third page, which it, with her, like, kicking the bikers' asses is it's, like, so well drawn. And it was kind of a strange page turn because there's nothing like it before. Like, it's a full page. It's not, like, there's no panels, and it's all just, like, a blue background of like different scenes of her like beating people up, which is great. And then I do really like that it does get into like where that issue goes from there of, you know, obviously it has this thing where at the end of the day, like all of them were just being brainwashed. Like it kind of does have, some of the stuff gets watered down by like some of those superhero tropes of like the white supremacists were all being brainwashed by one bad white supremacist, like the actual one bad guy, the rest of them were fine, which to be fair, like it's not totally untrue that like people are propagandized to and whatever, but they're not literally mind controlled. But I do really enjoy the rest of that issue. I think it has some of the like better action sequences in the series. The whole last like half of the issue where they're kind of fighting back and forth through the forest is really fun, and yeah, I like that issue a lot. I'm kind of two minds on this because on the one hand I do really appreciate a superhero story where it takes, you know, characters with like these insane metahuman powers and like forces them to be like sort of at the street ground level, like interacting with people day to day. Cause like usually that's left to like the Batmans or the Daredevils of the world.
Or the Green Arrows.
Yeah. Like the people who don't have like these big superpowers. So it's kind of compelling to see like a character, like a mythical character that actually is like having to engage with, you know, everyday life rather than like kind of brought down to earth in a way, like literally brought down to earth, is a really compelling.
I don't remember which issue it's in, but I remember there's like one scene where Black Canary uses like a judo move to like take down like a bigger guy that's coming towards her. And I enjoyed that. I thought it was very fun getting to see like a character use, you know, like not just sort of like brute strength fighting to get through a confrontation.
Yeah. There's some good Black Canary stuff in these issues. I mean, I
enjoyed getting to see some Black Canary. I like some Black Canary.
Yeah, yeah. It's also it's a little telling that, you know, when Speedy needs to go to somebody, it's like, go to Black Canary. The woman can handle it. Mm-hmm. We have to go take care of things the manly way. But, you know, everyone's got their blind spots, even in the back in the woke 1970s. They had a little misogyny.
Just a little bit. I found part of the... So in terms of, so when I did the interview with him, I have a little excerpt on how it happened, how the series happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I will read that now. Yes.
Yeah. Please do.
So I asked, tackled real life issues, how'd you come up with the idea, and were there any difficulties in getting it published? And he says that the reason that there was no issues getting it published is because the big office didn't know that they were going to publish it. His editor, Julie Schwartz, was basically like, hey... Holy as long shit. As and the reason it's a road trip was he said, hey, people are not going to buy two consecutive issues of a book, so you got to make sure they're kind of one shot styles. So that's why they did the road trip, so every issue was kind of like that kind of thing going on. But yeah, he wrote a story predicated on current events that it got published, then took off. Now this is the quote here. Herman Melville once said that to write a mighty book, you need a mighty theme. One of the things that we had going for us was that our stories were about real problems people could identify with. It wasn't about a guy in a funny suit. It was about people who have problems. The conventional wisdom at the time was that a comic book had a life of a month. I figured, well, we're pushing the envelope, so maybe it'll last 3 months. It's been 40 years, and I can look at these things over my bookshelf now. So it worked. And Neil Adams and I started getting invitations to go on radio and TV shows and a lot of publicity. My wife got a death threat. My wife got death threats for it from somebody down south, and my boss sent her flowers, which was a nice gesture on his part.
Wow.
Goddamn.
That's nuts.
Yeah. So
even the death threats haven't changed. We've always been doing death threats to people we don't agree with.
Yeah, but it's always
it really is. Yeah, that's true. That part hasn't changed. It is interesting insight, the whole like people aren't gonna read more than might not read more than one issue of a series, and the like trying to make something that's a little more, that's not so throwaway, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there's a lot of great comics from the Gold and Silver Age, but that is a really interesting perspective that like, and you don't even think about it now because now everything is written to be like six issues that you can collect and do a trade and then mm-hmm. sell to people in mm-hmm. Barnes and Noble or whatever. But that idea that like you have to finding a way to like have like one theme, but like completely disparate stories that are all mm-hmm. sort of riffs on,
yeah.
on the same themes.
And like, it's really like, cause some of these issues, like we said, they're like, I mean, most of them are like really heavy handed and kind of, it's kind of saying the same thing over and over and over again, which it works for the series. Cause like when you're reading them one after the other, it works. Cause it's like different situations and stuff like that. And when you're reading individually, it works. Cause hey, this is the only one you're reading. So it's like, you know, month to month basis. So
yeah,
no, it's a cool series for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess they do, so after the road trip, they do go into space for a little bit. And I'm curious how you guys felt about like the change in pace when they're all of a sudden they're, you know, they're no longer on Earth. They're like out fighting the robots and trying to reinstate the intergalactic cord. And then they go to the Guardians planet that's suffering from overpopulation. I'm curious how you guys felt about like the transition to those issues and how those issues like stacked up against the rest of the series.
Yeah. So basically I would have preferred more like Earth adventures, but like, I didn't hate the space adventures cause it felt like it was still like keeping with like the tone of how everything was happening.
I do enjoy the Guardians as sort of like a recurring antagonist, like, kind of always being the opposite of Green Arrow. I mean, not always, like they're not in every issue. Well, you don't see the Council at least in every issue. But I like the idea that they have, like, it is like another one of those things where it's like, it is more of a metaphor, but it is also like about something in the sense that, you know, they look at the universe through like through a very limited lens and a limited scope.
Yeah.
And it's just about upholding and maintaining laws that, you know, who knows if like, because apparently they have memorized the legal code of like every planet because they know that the landlord didn't technically, or they think he technically didn't commit any crimes, or there wasn't evidence of it when they told Hal to knock it off. But like, that's the only way that they're able to look at the galaxy, and having them still be on high like the whole time as someone for Hal to kind of go back to. And also for it's like so key to like Hal's disillusionment with like the Green Lantern Corps and kind of with himself throughout over the course of the series, of kind of realizing that, you know, he doesn't always know what's best, or the way he looks at the world has resulted in him, you know, not always like he's so sure of himself, but it really shakes a lot of his core beliefs, which I think is interesting. Like, yeah. You don't see that all that often with character, like, especially with comic book characters and superheroes who are supposed to be these like serialized characters that you can have that can be around for 100 years. Mm-hmm. Like, you get these stories where it's like, oh, Batman has his wealth taken away, or oh, Batman had his back broken, or Superman, or like, you know, Daredevil had his identity leaked to the public for the sixth time, you know, like these things that like really like kind of break characters down in a way where mm-hmm. they like puts them at a low point, but you don't often that's not often like an ideological thing or like
yeah.
a character mm-hmm. realizing they were wrong about like their fundamental understanding of like their position in the world. And so to do yeah. that to Green Lantern is in this series is really cool. So
I agree.
Yeah. And it leaves him in a place where like, you know, he's better at being a Green Lantern. So it doesn't take away the opportunity to do your silly superhero stories in the future or, you know, anything there. It just makes for,
well, I mean, there's plenty of silliness in this issue, like even in just the 10 issues that we read, and I'm sure there's more later on, but like mm-hmm. that whole issue with the school, the first Carol Ferris issue, like I don't think that's really saying anything. Like, oh,
that
guess,
issue
like,
is
sometimes
just, like, it'd be cool.
Sometimes bad people like adopt kids or I don't know. Like, I don't think it's saying anything.
No.
Really, but
no,
it is just like a superhero story. It's like the, we need to fill in of a month here. And
it was a weird issue where you're like, oh, yeah. by the way, Carol Ferris is paralyzed. Oh, by the way, now Hal Jordan yeah. and Carol Ferris are together. And it's like, it's told through this, exactly like the story of like, oh, telepathic kid and abusive parental figure. And they end up both dying. And it's like, what? What is this?
It's also crazy that like Carol Ferris is like with somebody. I think it's the principal of the school at the beginning. Yeah. And like they just don't address that. It's just as soon as Hal is like, no, I love you, Carol. She's like, me too. Perfect. I mean, good for them. Yeah. They're meant to be together. They're not in the current Green Lantern comics, but we're getting back to it. We're getting back. She has another evil boyfriend that Hal.
Oh no.
He's not revealed to be evil yet, but I'm pretty sure in like, you know, 10 issues, Hal's going to beat his ass for good reason.
Nice. So.
But yeah, I think that can do it for Green Lantern, Green Arrow. So I'm glad I finally got around to reading some of this, and you know, mm-hmm. probably go on and read some more of it.
I'm also glad that we decided to read this.
Yeah, and I'm curious to read more and see if it continues being like, oh wow, this is a cool cover and thing there, because like they went on for a long time, but I feel like after reading 11 issues, these are all the ones I know about or have heard about as sort of uh-huh. major seminal ones. So we'll see.
Well, I think that like the opening arc is just so iconic in terms of it being a, like not just because of like the themes, but also because of the audaciousness of just completely changing the structure of a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like it's obviously going to be remembered for that. And so like the, you know, obviously they could continue going down that road. And I think they do. Like, I don't think it's like just those first few issues are about like these sort of systemic problems and real life issues, but it, you know, it's hard to top like the start of a run where they're completely changing the status quo and doing something completely different. But yeah, no, I'm also interested to see what the future held for the series. But yeah, do you guys hear that sound?
What is it?
I don't know. You tell me. I don't know what that sound is. Alex, do you recognize it?
Okay, in 2018, Jeff Johns and Gary Frank came together to publish a limited maxi series called The Doomsday Clock.
That's true. And that happened.
It sounds similar. It kind of rhymes. Is this another Doomsday Clock?
Oh, I think that might be the Doomsday Clock. Yeah.
Nice.
Whoa. Good job figuring that out, Alex. because that means that it's time for our first cry space. Alex, do you have or Emily, do either of you have one prepared? I've got one. I mean, I can go first.
I have several that I'm just gonna like speed through because we like almost recorded this episode twice and like a lot has happened.
Uh-huh.
So
and you don't have any other means to talk to us about things going
yep.
on.
It's true.
Other than the cry space.
No, of course not.
Yep. Producers won't let us.
I got COVID. That sucked.
That does suck.
My wife also got COVID because I got COVID. That sucked. My computer decided to start giving my 10-year-old MacBook that I use for all of my work stuff decided to start giving me issues, so I had to replace my fucking laptop. I enjoyed Deadpool versus Wolverine, a thing that I did, or is it Deadpool and Wolverine? I know they fight in the movie, but
it's
it is the third movie, but there's not a three in
Deadpool
the
Deadpool and Wolverine.
Title.
It's a classic. Yeah. It's a classic team up. Yeah.
I enjoyed that movie, which is very distressing. I think that, and Gwen's been out of town and doesn't get back until Wednesday. So I've been very sad because my wife's been gone.
Wife gone.
So sad. So that's all the things that have made me cry recently.
Alex? That's good. I just got one. It's Rebel Moon. Sorry. I gotta get the name
this
right.
This is also my cry space, is that I have to hear you guys talk about Rebel Moon.
Oh, but that's it made true. Me so emotional.
Sure.
That's true.
I was really moved by it.
Uh-huh.
To be honest.
Yeah. So it's Jimmy's great. But Rebel Moon Part 1 Director's Cut. Chapter 1 Chalice of Blood, of course. That's the one.
Oh yeah, they do mention the Chalice of Blood a couple times, actually.
They do. I don't.
That's like
I
the
don't
thing know. Where it's like, I think it's like an immortality type deal. Like they do that whole scene where they're like walking through the long hallway, and there's all the portraits, and there's the one portrait of the woman who has the chalice, and she's
the Chalice of Blood,
bring peace to the realm, and I can't remember. Yeah.
Yeah, you remember more about the movie than I do, but I had already watched them. Unfortunately, I'd already watched Rebel Moon Part 1, because when it came out, me and Adam were home, and I was like, Adam, you know what we're doing tonight? We're going to watch Rebel Moon Part 1, and he's like, please don't. And then, you know, 2 hours later, it was like, that movie, like, it doesn't feel like a movie. Like, it feels like, it was just like, oh, let's get the gang back together for no real, and then it's over, and it's like, huh? So, the director's cut, filled in more stuff and was more of a movie, but all in all I've watched 5 hours of Rebel Moon content, and that's far too much.
And gonna be watching another 2.5 next weekend.
Yes.
I mean, come on, you don't want to know what happens. We spent 3.5 hours getting the whole gang together. There's Korra, there's the
Aang.
Is that which one is
Soka?
No, you're doing an Avatar bit. There's the resistance leader who died.
Yes.
There's
the general. Woman. The general.
Oh, the general. The general is great. There's this sick woman with the witch hat. Looks really cool. I gotta say, you gotta hand it to Zack Snyder on some things. Like the production design is kind of fire. But I think you do. I think some of the stuff in this movie looks really cool. Like, it's not his fault that it's on a Netflix budget, and so the CG frequently looks like dog shit.
It is his fault that it's like a bad story. But
yeah, that is his fault. That part, yeah, definitely. The fact that it's that long is crazy that the movie is just 3 hours of exposition. It is like a crazy way to make a movie, in my opinion. Some people probably like it, but I did not. But I'll be going back for more because I'm sick in the head.
Hell yeah.
And every time there's a Zack Snyder director's cut, I have to watch it.
It's true. You don't even watch the originals anymore.
Yeah, it's true. I'm not even fucking around with the... I don't want the uncut... I want only the pure uncut Zack Snyder. I don't want the watered down... Like, you know, like how like with drugs, like I don't want it cut with anything. I just want it pure.
Yep.
No, because that guy did the pure in the Speedy issue.
He died. He fucking died. Yeah.
Well, so far it hasn't killed me. Watching the Zack Snyder director's cut.
Are you sure?
And I don't think it will. I'm pretty sure. Well, maybe. Maybe it's a sort of like I was dead the whole time type deal.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, that'd be spooky.
Yeah. Rebel Moon, Part 1, Chalice of Blood, director's cut is also my cry space. I know it's kind of cheating for us to share one, but That was what I had planned. It's just so like, it's like the only thing I care about right now. I have to imagine, it would have been a really good bit if I did the thing where like I watched it and then it was like the only thing I posted about for like 2 weeks. Like sometimes, like usually people do that for things that are good, but like it might be funny to do it for something that's bad once. I'm sure there's a Snyder stan out there doing that.
Oh, there's, I'm sure. There's definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, sorry you guys had to hear about Rebel Moon Director's Cut Part 1.
I don't think you're Child that sorry.
Blood. I'm not that sorry. I just want everyone to watch it, is the thing. Because the thing that's really going to piss me off is if they don't get to make Part 3, which is planned, but apparently viewership was pretty low on these things, so...
I watched them twice. Fuck.
Well, also, I don't even have access to, like, a legal Netflix.
Oh, well, me neither.
So if
I guess we're not giving him any viewer.
If I were watching it, I would not be contributing to you getting another movie anyway. You know,
that's a good point. We also didn't do that. Somebody might have pirated a copy and then streamed it to a bunch of people in a Discord server. So I'm not, we didn't even up the view count. So I'm, you know what? I'm going to log into I'm going to log into my parents' Netflix account and I'm going to leave the movie on. I'm not going to use my computer for the next month. I'm just gonna have just it play it. Rebel Moon Director's Cut.
Loop it. There's also sorry, but you know, not to talk about Rebel Moon the whole time, and we gotta go. But there's a making of Rebel Moon featurette on
Netflix.
So we can get the
let's go
the mind behind the madness.
I will be checking that out. Yeah.
Wow.
All right. Well, you can find us online at Crying Book Club. Emily and Alex are on Twitter at Pandonata and at Alex Hantick, respectively. You can follow me on Letterboxd. I'm JL Botville. Emily has other podcasts. Imagine You've heard me of Utena, them. Fresh Podcast Market. You can also follow her on Letterboxd at Pandabore. And I think that's it. I think we'll be back in 2 weeks for more podcasts.
Yes, we'll be reading a manga.
I'm also hungry.
Yeah.
Well,
no, we're not reading a manga for next time. We're reading the opposite of a manga.
What's the opposite of a manga?
We're reading Alan Moore's From Hell.
That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit.
So, the opposite of a manga in the sense that it's probably good. But I don't know. I haven't read it. Maybe it sucks. Maybe I'm making us read a... I doubt it sucks.
Yeah, I'm just so reading what it's about. It's cool. Yeah, we're getting some Jack the Ripper fun.
Jack the Ripper. I hate to say it, but I was gonna say Al the Killer, who is not Jack the Ripper, but that tells you a lot about the kind of brain rot that I have. For people who are unaware, that's a character from the Amory Wars.
Go listen to our Coheed and Cambria episode. Cambria
podcast. If you want to hear my thoughts on how epic Al the Killer is, you can go listen to that. You can also watch the music video for the song The Joke, which features a live action Al the Killer.
The song kind of just whips.
The song goes crazy and everyone
goes crazy stupid hard.
And everyone loves Al the Killer.
Yep, that's what they say about that.
And yeah, so we'll be back to talk about Al the Killer, Jack the Ripper, next time. But until then, I don't have like a fun thing I say at the end, so I think I'm done talking.
Bye.
Okay.